Side 4, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 149. He frowned slightly. Was it altogether wise to entrust that kind of mission to a novice, Sparhawk? Beirut's a solid young man, Sparhawk explained, and he isn't widely known here in Simera. Most of the full-fledged knights are.
I see.
It was your command, Sparhawk. The decision was yours. How did things go in Arsham?
Ardis led the mercenaries, Carlton replied. We didn't see a sign of Martell. Otherwise, things went more or less as planned.
Ardis got away, though. Sparhawk drew in a deep breath.
We lost Parison, he said sadly.
I'm sorry, Vanion. I tried to keep him out of the fight.
Vanion's eyes clouded with sudden grief.
I know, Sparhawk said, touching the older man's shoulder.
I loved him, too.
He saw the quick look that passed between Vanion and Sophronia. She nodded slightly, as if to advise the preceptor that Sparhawk knew that Parasim had been one of the 12. Then Sparhawk straightened and introduced Count Radon and Vanion to each other.
I owe you my life, Lord Vanion, Radon said as they shook hands. Please tell me how I can repay you.
Your presence here in Simera is ample repayment, my lord.
Have the other kings joined my nephew as yet? The count asked.
Obler has, Vanion replied. King Worgen is still at sea, though.
A thin man dressed in a severe black cassock sat near the window. He appeared to be in his late 50s and had silvery hair. His face was ascetic, and his eyes were very keen. Sparhawk crossed the room and knelt respectfully before him.
Your Grace, he greeted the Patriarch of Deimos.
You're looking well, Sir Sparhawk, the churchman told him.
It's good to see you again.
Then he looked over Sparhawk's shoulder.
Have you been going to chapel, Curic? He asked the squire.
Whenever there's opportunity, Your Grace,
Curic answered, flushing slightly.
Excellent, my son, Dolmant said. I'm sure that God is always glad to see you. How are Asladi and the boys?
Well, Your Grace, thank you for asking.
Sophronia had been looking critically at the Patriarch.
You haven't been eating properly, Dolmant, she told him.
Sometimes I forget, he said. Then he smiled slyly at her. My overwhelming concern with the conversion of the heathens fills all my waking thoughts.
Tell me, Sophronia, are you ready at last to put aside your pagan ways and embrace the true faith?
Not yet, Dolmant, she replied, also smiling. It was nice of you to ask, though.
He laughed. I thought I'd get the question out of the way early so we can converse without having it hanging over our heads.
He looked curiously at Flute, who was walking about the room examining the furnishings.
And who is this beautiful child? He asked.
She's a foundling, Your Grace, Sparhawk replied. We came across her near the Arshan border. She doesn't talk, so we call her Flute.
Dolmant looked at the little girl's grass-stained feet.
And was there no time to bathe her? He asked.
That would not be appropriate, Your Grace, Sophronia replied.
The Patriarch looked puzzled at that. Then he looked again at Flute.
Come over here, child, he said.
Flute approached him warily.
And will you not speak, even to me?
She raised her pipes and blew a questioning little note.
I see, Dolmant said. Well then, Flute, will you accept my blessing?
She looked at him gravely, then shook her head.
She is a Styric child, Dolmant, Sophronia explained. An Aline blessing would have no meaning for her.
Flute then reached out and took the Patriarch's thin hand and placed it over her heart. Dolmant's eyes grew suddenly very wide, and his expression troubled.
She will give you her blessing, however, Sophronia told him. And will you accept it?
Dolmant's eyes were still wide.
I think perhaps that I should not, he said. But God help me, I will. And gladly.
Flute smiled at him and then kissed both of his palms. Then she pirouetted away, her black hair flying and her pipes sounding joyously. The Patriarch's face was filled with wonder.
I expect that I'll be summoned to the palace as soon as King Worgen arrives, Vanion said. Annius wouldn't want to miss the chance to confront me personally.
He looked at Count Radon.
"Did anyone see you arrive, my lord?" he asked.
Redden shook his head.
"I had my visor down, my lord Vanion, and at Sparhawk's suggestion I had covered the crest on my shield.
I'm positive that no one knows that I'm in Cimera."
"Good." Vanion grinned suddenly. "We wouldn't want to spoil the surprise for Annius, would we?"
The expected summons from the palace arrived 2 days later. Vanion, Sparhawk, and Colton put on the simple robes Pandion's customarily wore inside the chapter house, though beneath them they wore mail coats and their swords. Dolmant and Radin wore the cowled black robes of monks. Sophrenia wore her usual white. She had spoken at some length with Flute, and it appeared that the little girl had agreed to remain behind. Curic belted on a sword. "Just in case there's trouble," he grunted to Sparhawk before the party left the chapter house. The day was cold and raw. The sky was leaden, and a chill wind whistled through the streets of Cimera as Vanion led them toward the palace. There were few people abroad in the streets. Sparhawk could not be sure if the citizens were staying inside because of the weather, or because some rumors had leaked out about the possibility of trouble. Not too far from the palace gate, Sparhawk saw a familiar figure. A lame beggar boy wrapped in a ragged cloak crutched his way out from the corner where he had been sheltering himself.
"Charity, my lords! Charity!"
he begged in a broken-hearted voice. Sparhawk reined Farron in and reached inside his robe for a few coins.
"I need to talk with you, Sparhawk," the boy said quietly after the others had ridden out of earshot.
"Later," Sparhawk replied, bending to his saddle to place the coins in the boy's begging bowl.
"Not too much later, I hope," Talon said, shivering. "I'm freezing out here."
There was a brief delay at the palace gate where the guards tried to deny entrance to Vanion's escort. Colton resolved the problem by pulling open his robe and putting his hand meaningfully on his sword hilt. The discussion ended abruptly at that point, and the party rode on into the palace courtyard and dismounted.
"I love doing that," Colton said blithely.
"It doesn't take very much to make you happy, does it?" Sparhawk said.
"I'm a simple man, my friend, with simple pleasures."
They proceeded directly to the blue-draped council chamber, where the kings of Arsham, Deira, and Thalesia sat on throne-like chairs, flanking the slack-lipped Lycaeus. Behind each king stood a man in formal armor. The crests of the three other militant orders were emblazoned on their surcoats. Abriel, preceptor of the Cyrenic Knights in Arsham, stood sternly behind King Dragos. Darylon, preceptor of the Alcyone Knights of Deira, had taken up a similar position behind the aged King Obler. And the big-boned Comier, leader of the Genidian Knights, stood behind King Worgen of Thalesia. Although it was early in the day, Worgen was already bleary-eyed. He held a large silver cup in a hand that was visibly shaking. The royal council of advisers sat to one side of the room. The face of the Earl of Lenda was troubled, while that of the Baron Harperin was smug. The primate Annius wore a purple satin cassock, and the expression on his emaciated face was coldly triumphant as Vanion entered. When he saw the rest of them accompanying the Pandion preceptor, however, his eyes flashed angrily.
"Who authorized this entourage of yours, Lord Vanion?" he demanded. "The summons did not mention an escort."
"I require no authorization, Your Grace," Vanion answered coldly. "My rank is all the authority I need."
"That's true," the Earl of Lenda said. "Law and custom support the preceptor's position."
Annius gave the old man a look filled with hate. "What a comfort it is to have the advice of one so versed in the law," he said in a sarcastic voice. Then his eyes fell on Sophrenia. "Remove that styric witch from my presence," he demanded.
"No," Vanion said. "She stays." Their eyes locked for a long moment, and Annius finally looked away.
"Very well then, Vanion," he said. "Because of the seriousness of the matter I am about to present to their majesties, I will control my natural revulsion at the presence of a heathen sorceress."
"You're too kind," Sophrenia murmured.
"Just get on with it, Annius," King Dragos said irritably. "We're gathered here to examine certain irregularities involving the throne of Elaenia. What is this burning matter that is important enough to delay our inquiry?"
Annius straightened.
"The matter concerns you directly, Your Majesty. Last week, a body of armed men attacked a castle in the eastern part of your kingdom."
King Dragos's eyes blazed.
"Why was I not informed?" he demanded.
"Forgive me, Your Majesty," Annius apologized. "I myself learned of the incident only recently, and I felt it wiser to present the matter to this council rather than to advise you in advance.
Although this outrage occurred within the boundaries of your kingdom, the implications of it spread beyond your borders to all four western kingdoms.
Get on with it, Annius, King Worgen growled. Save the flowery language for your sermons.
As your majesty wishes, Annius said, bowing. There are witnesses to this criminal act, and I think perhaps it were best that your majesties hear their accounts directly rather than at second hand from me. He turned and gestured to one of the red-liveried church soldiers who lined both walls of the council chamber. The soldier stepped to a side door and admitted a nervous-looking man whose face went visibly pale when he saw Vanion.
Don't be afraid, Tessera, Annius told him. So long as you tell the truth, no harm will come to you.
Yes, your grace, the nervous man mumbled.
This is Tessera, Annius introduced him, a merchant of this city who has recently returned from Arsham. Tell us what you saw there, Tessera.
Well, your grace, it was as I told you before. I was in Serenium on business. I was returning from there when I was overtaken by a storm, and I took shelter in the castle of Count Radon, who was kind enough to take me in.
Tessera's voice had the sing-song quality some people assume when they are reciting something previously committed to memory.
Anyway, he went on, after the weather cleared, I was preparing to leave, and I was in the Count's stables, seeing to my horse. I heard the sounds of many men in the courtyard, so I peered out the stable door to see what was happening. It was a sizable body of Pandion knights.
Are you certain that they were Pandions? Annius prompted him.
Yes, your grace. They were wearing black armor and carrying Pandion banners. The Count is well known to be most respectful of the church and her knights, so he had admitted them without challenge. As soon as they were inside the walls, however, they all drew their swords and began to kill everyone in sight.
My uncle?
King Dragos exclaimed.
The Count tried to fight them, of course, but they quickly disarmed him and tied him to a stake in the center of the courtyard. They killed all the men inside the castle, and then...
All the men? Annius interrupted him, his face suddenly stern.
They killed all the men inside the castle, and then...
Tessera faltered.
Oh, I almost forgot that part. They killed all the men inside the castle, except for the churchmen, and then they brought out the Count's wife and daughters. They were all stripped naked and then violated before the Count's eyes.
A sob escaped the King of Arsham.
My aunt and my cousins, he cried.
Steady, Dragos, King Worgen said, putting his hand on the other king's shoulder.
Then, Tessera continued, after the Count's womenfolk had all been repeatedly raped, they were dragged one by one to a spot directly before where the Count was tied, and their throats were cut. The Count wept and tried to tear his hands free, but his bonds were too tight. He pleaded with the Pandions to stop, but they only laughed and continued their butchery. Finally, when his wife and daughters were all dead and lying in their own blood, he asked them why they were doing this. One of them, the leader, I think, replied that it was on the orders of Lord Vanion, the preceptor of the Pandions.
King Dragos leaped to his feet. He was weeping openly and clawing at his sword hilt. Annius stepped in front of him.
I share your outrage, your majesty, but a quick death for this monstrous Vanion would be far too merciful. Let us hear this good, honest man out.
Go on with your account, Tessera.
There isn't much more to tell, your grace, Tessera replied. Once the Pandions had killed all the women, they tortured the Count to the point of death. And then they beheaded him. After that, they drove the churchmen out of the castle and looted the place.
Thank you, Tessera, Annius said. He motioned to another of his soldiers, and the guard went to the same side door to admit a man dressed in a peasant smock. The peasant had a slightly furtive look, and he was trembling noticeably.
Say your name, fellow, Annius ordered.
I am Verl, your grace, an honest serf from the estate of Count Radon.
And why are you in Simera? A serf may not leave the estate of his lord without permission.
I fled, your grace, after the murder of the Count and all his family.
Can you tell us what happened? Did you witness this atrocity?
Not directly, your grace. I was working in a field near the Count's castle when I saw a large group of men dressed in black armor and carrying the banners of the Pandion knights ride out of the castle. One of them had the Count's head on the point of his spear. I hid myself and I could hear them talking and laughing as they rode by.
What were they saying?
The one who was carrying the Count's head said, "We must carry this trophy to Deimos to prove to Lord Vanion that we have carried out his orders." After they had gone past, I ran to the castle and found everyone inside dead. I was afraid that the Pandions might come back, so I ran away.
Why did you come to Simera?
To report the crime to you, Your Grace, and to place myself under your protection. I was afraid that if I stayed in Arsham, the Pandions would hunt me down and kill me.
Why did you do this? Dragos demanded of Vanion. My uncle has never given any offense to your order.
The other kings were also glaring at the Pandion preceptor accusingly. Dragos wheeled to glare at Prince Lycaeus.
I insist that this murderer be placed in chains.
Lycaeus tried without much success to look like a king.
Your demand is reasonable, Your Majesty,
he said in his nasal voice. He cast a quick look at Annius, seeking reassurance.
We therefore command that this miscreant Vanion be placed...
Excuse me, Your Majesties, the Earl of Lenda interposed. But by law, Lord Vanion is entitled to present his defense.
What defense can there possibly be?
Dragos asked in a sick voice. Sparhawk and the others had remained at the back of the council chamber. Sifrania made a small gesture, and Sparhawk leaned toward her.
Someone here is using magic, she whispered. That's why the kings are so willing to accept the infantile charges against Vanion. The spell induces belief.
Can you counter it? He whispered back.
Only if I know who's doing it.
It's Annius. He tried a spell on me when I first came back to Simera.
A churchman?
She looked surprised.
All right. I'll take care of it.
Her lips began to move and she concealed her hands in her sleeves to hide their gesturing.
Well, Vanion, Annius sneered, what have you to say for yourself?
These men are obviously lying, Vanion replied scornfully. Why would they lie?
Annius turned to the king seated at the front of the room.
As soon as I received the reports of these witnesses, I dispatched a troop of church soldiers to the Count's castle to verify the details of this crime. I expect their report within the next week. In the meantime, it is my recommendation that the Pandion knights all be disarmed and confined within their chapter houses to prevent any further atrocities.
King Obler stroked his long gray beard.
Under the circumstances, that would be the prudent course, he said sagely.
He turned to Darylon of the Alcyone Knights.
My lord Darylon, he said, dispatch a rider to Deira. Tell him to bring your knights to Elenia. They are to assist the civil authorities here in disarming and confining the Pandions.
It shall be as your majesty commands, Darylon replied, glaring at Vanion.
The aged king of Deira looked at King Worgen and King Dragos.
I would strongly advise that the Cyrenix and Genidians also send forces, he said. Let us seal up these Pandions until we can separate the innocent from the guilty.
See to it, Comier, King Worgen said. Send your knights as well, Abriel,
King Dragos commanded the preceptor of the Cyrenix. He glared at Vanion with hate-filled eyes.
I pray that your underlings attempt to resist, he said fiercely.
A splendid idea, your majesties, Annius said, bowing. I would further suggest that as soon as we receive confirmation of the murders, your majesties travel with me and these two honest witnesses to Kyrelos. There we can lay the entire affair before the hierocracy of the church, and the archprelate himself with our strong recommendation that the Pandion order be disbanded. Strictly speaking, that order is under church authority, and only the church can make the final decision.
Truly, Dragos grated, let us rid ourselves of this Pandion infection once and for all.
A thin smile touched the primate's lips. Then he flinched, and his face went deathly pale as Sifrania released her counterspell. It was at that point that Dolman stepped forward, pushing back the hood of his monk's robe to reveal his face.
May I speak, Your Majesties? He asked.
Your Grace! Annius stammered in surprise. I didn't know that you were in Simera.
I didn't think you did, Annius. As you've so correctly pointed out, the Pandions are under church authority. As the ranking churchman present, I think it's proper for me to take charge of this inquiry. You are to be commended for the way in which you have conducted things thus far, however.
But
that will be all, Annius, Dolmat dismissed him.
He turned then to the kings and to Lycaeus, who was staring open-mouthed at him.
Your Majesties, the Patriarch began, pacing back and forth with his hands clasped behind him as if deep in thought. This is indeed a serious accusation. Let us, however, consider the character of the accusers. On the one hand, we have an untitled merchant, and on the other, a runaway serf.
The accused is the preceptor of an order of church knights, a man whose honor has always been above question. Why would a man of Lord Vanion's stature commit such a crime? Indeed, we have as yet received no substantiation that the crime did in fact take place. Let us not move in haste.
As I mentioned, Your Grace, Annius injected, I have dispatched church soldiers to Arsham to view the scene of the crime with their own eyes.
I have also ordered them to seek out the churchmen who were in the castle of Count Radden and witness this horror, and to return with them to Simmera. Their reports should leave no doubts whatsoever.
Ah, yes, Dolmant agreed. None whatsoever. I think, however, that I might be able to save us a bit of time. As it happens, I myself have with me a man who witnessed what happened at the castle of Count Radden, and I don't think his testimony can be questioned by any man here. He looked at the robed and cowled Count Radden, who had remained unobtrusively at the rear of the chamber. "Would you be so good as to step forward, brother?" he said. Annius was gnawing on a fingernail. His expression clearly showed his chagrin at having the proceedings taken out of his grasp, and at the appearance of Dolmant's unexpected witness. "Would you reveal your identity to us, brother?" Dolmant asked mildly as the Count joined him before the king's. There was a tight grin on Radden's face as he pushed back his hood.
"Uncle!"
King Dragos gasped in astonishment.
"Uncle!"
King Worgen exclaimed, coming to his feet and spilling his wine.
"This is Count Radden, my uncle,"
Dragos told him, his eyes still wide with amazement.
"You seem to have made an astonishing recovery, Radden," Worgen laughed. "My congratulations. Tell me, how did you stick your head back on?"
Annius had gone very pale. He stared in stunned disbelief at Count Radden.
"How did you—"
he blurted. Then he recovered. He looked around wildly for an instant, as if seeking a way to escape. Then he seemed to get hold of himself.
"Your Majesties," he stammered, "I have been misled by false witnesses. Please forgive me."
He was visibly sweating now.
Then he spun about. "Seize those two liars."
He pointed at Tessera and Verl, who were both cringing in terror. Several red-liveried guards quickly rushed the pair from the room. "Annius thinks very fast on his feet, doesn't he?" Calton murmured to Sparhawk. "How much would you care to wager that those two will manage somehow to hang themselves before the sun goes down? With a certain amount of help, of course."
"I'm not a betting man, Calton," Sparhawk replied. "Not on a proposition like that, anyway."
"Why don't you tell us what really happened at your castle, Count Radden?" Dolmant suggested.
"It was really fairly simple, Your Grace," Radden replied.
"Sir Sparhawk and Sir Calton arrived at my gates some time ago and warned me that a group of men dressed in the armor of Pandion knights were planning to gain entry by subterfuge and murder me and my family."
They had a number of real Pandions with them. When the impostors arrived, Sir Sparhawk led his knights against them and drove them off.
"Fortuitous," King Obler observed. "Which of these stalwarts is Sir Sparhawk?"
Sparhawk stepped forward.
"I am, Your Majesty."
"How did you become aware of this plot?"
"It was quite by accident, Your Majesty. I happened to overhear a conversation concerning it. I immediately informed Lord Vanion, and he ordered Calton and me to take preventive steps."
King Dragos rose to his feet and came down from the dais.
"I have wronged you, Lord Vanion," he said in a thick voice. "Your motives were the very best, and I accused you. Can you forgive me?"
"There is nothing to forgive, Your Majesty," Vanion replied. "Under the circumstances, I'd have done exactly the same." The Arshan King took the preceptor's hand and clasped it warmly.
"Tell me, Sir Sparhawk," King Obler asked, "could you by chance identify the plotters?"
"I couldn't see their faces, Your Majesty."
"A shame, really," the old king sighed. "It would appear that the plot was fairly widespread. The two who came before us to testify would also seem to have been a part of it, and at some prearranged signal were to have stepped forward with their obviously well-coached lies."
"That same thought had occurred to me, Your Majesty," Sparhawk agreed.
"But who was behind it, and against whom was it really directed? Count Radden, perhaps? Or King Dragos? Or even Lord Vanion?"
"That might be impossible to determine, unless the so-called witnesses can be persuaded to identify their fellow plotters."
Excellent point, Sir Sparhawk. King Obler looked sternly at the primate Aeneas. It lies upon you, Your Grace, to ensure that the merchant Tessera and the serf Verl are available for questioning. We would all be most distressed should anything of a permanent nature happen to either of them. Aeneas's face grew stiff. I shall have them both closely guarded, Your Majesty, he assured the King of Deira. He gestured to one of his soldiers and muttered some instructions to the man, who blanched slightly, then hurried from the room. Sir Sparhawk, Lycaeus blustered, you were ordered to Deimos and told to remain there until you received permission to leave. Why is it that you... Be still, Lycaeus, Aeneas snapped at him. A slow flush crept up the pimpled young man's face. I would say that you owe Lord Vanion an apology, Aeneas, Dolmant said pointedly. Aeneas paled, and then turned stiffly to the Pandion chief. Please accept my apologies, Lord Vanion, he said shortly. I was misled by liars. Of course, my dear primate, Vanion replied. We all blunder from time to time, don't we? I believe that more or less concludes this matter, then, Dolmant said. He cast a sidelong glance at Aeneas, who was obviously making a great effort to control his emotions. Be assured, Aeneas, the Patriarch of Deimos said to him. I will cast this entire matter in as charitable a light as I can when I make my report to the hierocracy in Kyrellos. I'll try my very best not to make you look like a complete idiot. Aeneas bit his lip.
Tell us, Sir Sparhawk, King Obler said. Could you in any way identify the people who approached the Count's castle?
The man who was leading them is named Ardus, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told him. He's a thick-witted savage who does the bidding of a renegade Pandion named Martell. Many of his men were just ordinary mercenaries. The rest were Rendors. Rendors? King Dragos said, his eyes narrowing. There have been tensions of late between my kingdom and Rendor, but this plot seems a bit involuted for the Rendorish mind. We could spend hours in speculation, Dragos, King Worgen said, holding his empty wine cup out for a serving man to refill. An hour or so on the rack should persuade the merchant and the serf down in the dungeon to tell us what they know about their fellow plotters.
The Church does not approve of such methods, Your Majesty, Dolmant said.
Worgen snorted derisively.
The dungeons beneath the Basilica of Kyrellos are reputed to employ the most expert interrogators in the world, he said.
That practice is being discontinued.
Perhaps, Worgen said. But this is a civil matter. We're not constrained by churchly delicacy, and I, for one, don't propose to wait while you pray an answer out of those two.
Lycaeus, who had been smarting from the almost absent-minded rebuke Aeneas had delivered to him, straightened on his throne-like chair.
We are delighted that this matter has been resolved so amicably, he announced, and we rejoice that the reports concerning the death of Count Radon have proved to be unfounded. I agree with the Patriarch of Deimos that we can consider this inquiry concluded. Unless Lord Vanion's excellent witnesses can shed further light on just who might have been behind this monstrous conspiracy.
No, Your Highness, Vanion told him. We are not prepared at this time to do so. Lycaeus turned to the kings of Thalesia, Deira, and Arsham, trying with scant success to look regal.
Our time, Your Majesties, is short, he said. We each have kingdoms to rule, and there are other matters requiring our attention. I suggest that we tender Lord Vanion our appreciation for his aid in clarifying this situation, and give him permission to withdraw, so that we may turn to state matters.
The kings nodded their agreement.
You and your friends may leave now, Lord Vanion, Lycaeus said grandly.
Thank you, Your Highness, Vanion replied with a stiff bow. We are all happy to have been of service to you. He turned and started toward the door.
A moment, Lord Vanion.
Darylon, the slightly built preceptor of the Alcyone Knights, said. Then he stepped forward.
Since Your Majesty's conversations will now turn on state matters, I think that I, Lord Comier, and Lord Abriel, will also withdraw. We are little versed in statecraft and could contribute nothing of value to your discussions. The matter that has come to light this morning, however, requires some consultation among the militant orders. Should conspiracies of this nature recur, we must make preparations to meet them.
Well said, Comier agreed.
A splendid idea, Darylon, King Obler assented.
let's not be caught asleep again. Keep me advised of the thrust of your discussions.
You may rely upon me, Your Majesty.
The preceptors of the other three orders marched down from the dais and joined Vanion, who led the way from the ornate audience chamber. Once they were out in the corridor, Comier, the hulking preceptor of the Genidian Knights, grinned openly.
Very neat, Vanion, he said.
I'm glad you liked it, Vanion grinned back.
My head must have been packed in wool this morning, Comier confessed. Would you believe I almost accepted all that tripe?
It was not entirely your fault, Lord Comier, Sophronia told him. He gave her a questioning look. Let me think my way through it a bit more, she said, frowning. The big Thalesian looked at Vanion.
It was Aeneas, wasn't it? He guessed shrewdly as they progressed down the hall. The scheme was his, I take it.
Vanion nodded. The Pandion presence in Elenia is hindering his operations. He saw this as a way to remove us.
Elenian politics get a bit dense sometimes. We're much more direct in Thalesia. Just how powerful is the Primate of Cimera?
Vanion shrugged.
He controls the Royal Council. That makes him more or less the ruler of the kingdom. Does he want the throne for himself?
No, I don't think so. He prefers to manipulate things from behind the scenes. He's trying to groom Lycaeus for the throne.
Lycaeus is a bastard, isn't he?
Vanion nodded again.
How can a bastard be king? Nobody knows who his father is.
Aeneas probably believes he can get around that problem. Until Sparhawk's father intervened, our good primate had very nearly convinced King Aldreas that it was perfectly legitimate for him to marry his own sister.
That's disgusting, Comier shuddered. I've heard that Aeneas has certain ambitions involving the archprelate's throne in Kyrellos.
Abriel, the gray-haired preceptor of the Cyrenic Knights, said to Patriarch Dolmant.
I've heard some of the same rumors myself, Dolmant replied blandly.
This humiliation is going to be quite a setback for him, isn't it? The hierocracy is likely to look with some disfavor on a man who makes a total ass of himself in public.
That thought had crossed my mind as well.
And your report will be quite detailed, I expect.
That is my obligation, Lord Abriel. Dolmant said piously.
As a member of the hierocracy myself, I could hardly conceal any of the facts, could I?
I will have to present the whole truth to the high councils of the church.
We wouldn't have it any other way, Your Grace.
We're going to need to talk, Vanion. Darylon, the preceptor of the Alcyone Knights, said seriously. This scheme was directed at you and your order this time. But it concerns us all. It could be any one of us the next time. Is there some place secure where we can discuss this matter?
Our chapter house is on the eastern edge of the city, Vanion replied. I can guarantee that none of the primate's spies are inside its walls.
As they rode out through the palace gates, Sparhawk remembered something and slowed to ride with Curic at the rear of the column.
What's the matter? Curic asked.
Let's drop behind a little bit. I want to talk with that beggar boy.
That's hardly good manners, Sparhawk. Curic said.
A meeting of the preceptors of all four orders happens about once in a lifetime, and they're going to have some questions for you.
We can catch up with them before they get to the chapter house.
What do you want to talk to a beggar for? Curic sounded more than a little irritated.
He's working for me.
Sparhawk gave his friend an appraising look.
What's bothering you, Curic? He asked. Your face looks like a rain cloud. Never mind, Curic replied shortly.
Talon was still huddled in the angle between two intersecting walls. He had his ragged cloak wrapped about him, and he was shivering. Sparhawk dismounted a few feet from the boy and made some pretense of checking his saddle girth.
What did you want to tell me? He said quietly.
That man you had me watching, Talon began. Trager, wasn't that his name? He left Cimera about the same time you did, but he came back a week or so later. There was another man with him, a fellow with white hair. It sort of stands out because he's not really that old. Anyway, they went to the house of that baron who's so fond of little boys. They stayed there for several hours, then they rode out of town again. I got close enough to them at the east gate to hear them talking with the gate guards. When the guard asked their destination, they said they were going to Camoria.
Good lad, Sparhawk congratulated him, dropping a gold crown into the begging bowl.
Child's play, Talon shrugged. He bit the coin and then tucked it inside his tunic.
Thanks, Sparhawk.
Why didn't you tell the porter at the inn on Rose Street?
The place is being watched. I decided to play it safe.
Then Talon looked over the big knight's shoulder.
Hello, Curic, he said. I haven't seen you for a long time.
You two know each other? Sparhawk was a bit surprised. Curic flushed, looking embarrassed.
You wouldn't believe how far back our friendship goes, Sparhawk, Talon said with a sly little smile at Curic.
That's enough, Talon, Curic said sharply. Then his expression softened slightly. How's your mother? He asked. There was a strange, wistful note in his voice.
She's doing quite well, actually. When you add what I make to what you give her from time to time, she's comfortably off.
Am I missing something here? Sparhawk asked mildly.
It's a personal matter, Sparhawk, Curic told him. Then he turned to the boy.
What are you doing out here in the streets, Talon? He demanded.
I'm begging, Curic. You see?
Talon held out his bowl.
That's what this is for. Would you like to drop something in for old time's sake?
I put you in a very good school, boy.
Oh, it was very good indeed. The headmaster used to tell us how good it was 3 times a day, at meal times. He and the other teachers ate roast beef. The students got porridge. I don't like porridge all that much, so I enrolled in a different school.
He gestured extravagantly at the street.
This is my classroom now. Do you like it? The lessons I learn here are much more useful than rhetoric or philosophy or all that tiresome theology. If I pay attention, I can earn enough to buy my own roast beef. Or anything else, for that matter.
I ought to thrash you, Talon, Curic threatened.
Why, father, the boy replied, wide-eyed. What a thing to suggest,
he laughed.
Besides, you'd have to catch me first. That's the first lesson I learned in my new school. Would you like to see how well I learned it?
He took up his crutch and begging bowl and ran off down the street. He was, Sparhawk noted, very fast on his feet. Curic started to swear. Father, Sparhawk asked.
I told you that this is none of your business, Sparhawk.
We don't keep any secrets from each other, Curic.
You're going to push this, aren't you?
Me? I'm just curious, that's all. This is a side of you I've never seen before.
I was indiscreet some years ago.
That's a delicate way to put it.
I can do without the clever remarks, Sparhawk.
Does Azladi know about this?
Of course not. It would only make her unhappy if I told her. I kept quiet about it to spare her feelings. A man owes that to his wife, doesn't he?
I understand perfectly, Curic, Sparhawk assured him. And was Talon's mother so very beautiful? Curic sighed, and his face grew oddly soft. She was 18, and like a spring morning. I couldn't help myself, Sparhawk. I love Azladi, but... Sparhawk put his arm around his friend's shoulder. It happens sometimes, Curic, he said. Don't beat yourself over the head about it.
Then he straightened. Why don't we see if we can catch up with the others, he suggested, as he swung back up into his saddle.
Part 2 Kyrillos. Chapter 10. Lord Abriel, the preceptor of the Cyrenic Knights of Arsham, stood at the green-draped window of Vanion's study in the south tower of the Pandion Knights chapter house, looking out at the city of Simera. Abriel was a solidly built man in his 60s, with silvery hair. His lined face was devoid of humor, and his eyes were sunk deep in their sockets. He had removed his sword and helmet upon their arrival, but still wore the rest of his armor and his pale blue surcoat. Since he was the eldest of the 4 preceptors, the others deferred to him.
I'm sure that we're all aware of most of what's been happening here in Alania, he began. But there are a few things that need a little clarification, I think. Would you mind if we asked you some questions, Vanion?
Not at all, Vanion replied. We'll all try our best to answer any that you might have.
Good. We've had our differences in the past, my lord, but in this situation we'll want to set those aside.
Abriel, like all the Cyrenics, spoke in a considered, even formal fashion.
I think we need to know more about this Martell person.
Vanion leaned back in his chair.
He was a Pandion, he replied with a trace of sadness in his voice. I was forced to expel him from the Order.
That's a little terse, Vanion, Comier said. Unlike the others, Comier wore a mail shirt rather than formal armor. He was a heavy-boned man with thick shoulders and large hands.
Like most Thalesians, the preceptor of the Genidian knights was blonde, and his shaggy eyebrows gave his face an almost brutish look. As he spoke, he continually toyed with the hilt of his broadsword, which lay on the table before him.
If this Martell's going to be a problem, we all ought to know as much about him as we can.
Martell was one of the best, Sophronia said quietly. She sat in her hooded white robe before the fire, holding her teacup. He was extremely proficient in the secrets. That, I think, is what led to his disgrace.
He was good with a lance, too, Calton admitted ruefully. He used to unhorse me on a regular basis on the practice field. Sparhawk was probably the only one who was a match for him. Exactly what was this disgrace you mentioned, Sophronia? Lord Darylon asked. The preceptor of the Alcyone Knights of Deira was a slender man in his late 40s. His massive Deiran armor looked almost too heavy for his slight frame. Sophronia sighed.
The secrets of Styricum are myriad, she replied. Some are fairly simple, common spells and incantations. Martell mastered those very quickly. Beyond commonplace magic, however, lies a deeper and far more dangerous realm. Those of us who instruct the Knights of the Church in the secrets do not introduce our pupils to that level of magic. It serves no practical purpose, and it involves things that imperil the souls of Alleans. Comyr laughed.
Many things imperil the souls of Alleans, my lady, he said. I felt a certain wrench in mine the first time I contacted the troll gods. I gather that this Martell of yours dabbled in things he should not have?
Sophronia sighed again. Yes, she admitted. He came to me asking that I instruct him in the forbidden secrets. He was very intense about it. That's one of Martell's characteristics. I refused him, of course, but there are renegade Styricks even as there are renegade Pandions. Martell came from a wealthy family, so he could afford to pay for the instruction he wanted.
Who found him out? Darylon asked. I did, Sparhawk said. I was riding from Simera to Deimos. That was shortly before King Aldreas sent me into exile. There's a patch of woods 3 leagues this side of Deimos. It was just about dusk when I passed those woods, and I saw a strange light back among the trees. I went to investigate, and saw Martell. He'd raised some kind of glowing creature. Its light was very bright, so bright that I couldn't make out its face.
I don't think you'd have wanted to see its face, Sparhawk, Sophronia told him.
Perhaps not, he agreed. Anyway, Martell was speaking to the creature in Styric, commanding it to do his bidding. That doesn't seem like anything out of the ordinary, Comyr said. We've all raised spirits or ghosts of one kind or another from time to time.
This was not precisely a spirit, Lord Comyr, Sophronia told him. It was a Damorc. The elder gods of Styricum created them to serve as slaves to their will. The Damorcs have extraordinary powers, but they are soulless. A god can summon them from that unimaginable place where they dwell and control them. For a mortal to attempt that, however, is sheer folly. No mortal can control a Damorc. What Martell had done is absolutely forbidden by all of the younger gods.
And the elder gods? Darylon asked.
The elder gods have no rules, my lord, only whims and desires.
Sophronia, Dolmant pointed out, Martell is an Alleen. Perhaps he felt no obligation to observe the prohibitions of the gods of Styricum.
So long as one is practicing the arts of Styricum, one is subject to the Styric gods, Dolmant, she replied.
I wonder if perhaps it might have been a mistake to arm the church knights with Styric magic as well as conventional weapons, Dolmant mused. We seem to be dabbling in an area best left untapped. That decision was made over 900 years ago, Your Grace, Abriel reminded him, coming back to the table. And if the knights of the church had not been proficient in magic, the Zaymarks would have won that battle on the plains of Lamarkand.
Perhaps, Dolmant said.
Go on with your story, Sparhawk, Comyr suggested.
There's not too much more, my lord. I didn't know what the Damorc was until Sophronia told me about it later, but I knew that it was something we were forbidden to contact. After a while, the thing vanished, and I rode in to talk with Martell. We were friends, and I wanted to warn him that what he was doing was prohibited. But he seemed almost mad, somehow. He shrieked at me and told me to mind my own business. That didn't leave me any choice. I rode on to our mother house at Deimos and reported what I'd seen to Vanion and Sophronia. She told us what the creature was and how dangerous it was to have it loose in the world.
Vanion ordered me to take a number of men and to apprehend Martell and to bring him to the Mother House for questioning. He went completely wild when we approached him, and he went to his sword. Martell's very good to begin with, and his madness made him all the more savage. I lost a couple of very close friends that day. We finally managed to overpower him, and we dragged him back to the Mother House in chains. By the ankles, as I recall, Calton added, Sparhawk can be very direct when he's irritated. He smiled at his friend. You didn't endear yourself to him by doing it that way, Sparhawk, he said. I wasn't trying to. He'd just killed two of my friends, and I wanted to give him plenty of reasons to accept my challenge when Vanion was finished with him. Anyway, Vanion took up the story, when they brought Martell back to Deimos, I confronted him. He didn't even try to deny what he'd been doing. I ordered him to stop practicing the forbidden secrets, and he defied me. I had no choice but to expel him from the order at that point. I stripped him of his knighthood and his armor, and turned him out the front gate. That could have been a mistake, Comier grunted. I'd have had him killed. Did he raise that thing again? Vanion nodded. Yes, but Sophrania appealed to the younger gods of Styricum, and they exorcised it. Then they stripped Martell of the most significant of his powers. He went away weeping and swearing revenge upon us all. He is still dangerous, but at least he can't summon up horrors anymore. He left Elenia, and he's been hiring his sword out to the highest bidder in other parts of the world for the past 10 or 12 years. He's just a common mercenary, then? Darylon asked. The slender Alcyone preceptor had an intent look on his narrow face. Not quite common, my lord, Sparhawk disagreed. He's had Pandion training. He could have been the very best of us, and he's very clever. He has wide contacts with mercenaries all over Eosia. He can raise an army at a moment's notice, and he's totally ruthless. I don't believe that Martell believes in anything anymore. What does he look like? Darylon asked. A little bigger than medium size, Calton replied. He's about the same age as Sparhawk and me, but he's got white hair. He has had it since he was in his 20s. I think we might all want to keep an eye out for him, Abriel suggested. Who's the other one? Ardus? Ardus is an animal, Calton told him. After Martell was expelled from the Pandions, he recruited Ardus and a man named Kroger to help him in his activities.
Ardus is a Pelosian, I think, or maybe a Lamerck. He can barely talk, so his accent is a little hard to identify.
He's a total savage, devoid of human feelings. He enjoys killing people, slowly, and he's very good at it.
And the other one? Comier asked. Kroger?
Kroger's fairly intelligent, Sparhawk replied. Basically, he's a criminal. False coins, extortion, fraud, that sort of thing. But he's weak. Martell trusts him to perform tasks that Ardus wouldn't be able to understand.
What's the link between Annius and Martell? Count Radin asked.
Probably nothing more than money, my lord, Sparhawk shrugged. Martell is for hire, and he has no strong convictions about anything. There are rumors that he has about half a ton of gold hidden somewhere.
I was right, Comier said bluntly. You should have killed him, Vanion.
I made the offer, Sparhawk said, but Vanion said no.
I had reasons, Vanion said.
Was there anything significant about the fact that there were Rendors in the party that attacked Count Radin's house? Abriel asked then.
Probably not, Sparhawk replied.
I've just come back from Rendor. There's a pool of mercenaries there in the same way that there is in Pelosia, Lamarkand, and Camoria. Martell draws on those people whenever he needs men. Renderish mercenaries have no particular religious convictions, Ashandist or otherwise.
Do we have enough evidence against Annius to take before the hierocracy in Kyrellos? Darylon asked.
I don't think so, Patriarch Dolmant said. Annius has bought many voices in the higher councils of the Church. Any charges we might bring against him would have to be supported by overwhelming proof. All we have now is an overheard conversation between Kroger and Baron Harperin. Annius could wriggle out of that rather easily, or simply buy his way out of it.
Comier leaned back in his chair, tapping at his chin with one finger. I think the Patriarch has just put his finger on the key to the whole affair. As long as Annius has his hands on the Elenian treasury, he can finance those schemes of his and continue to buy support in the hierocracy. If we aren't careful, he'll bribe his way to the Archprelacy. We've all stood in his path from time to time, and I guess that his first act as Archprelate would be to disband all four militant orders.
Is there any way we can cut off his access to those funds?
Vanion shook his head.
He controls the Royal Council, except for the Earl of Lenda. They vote him all the money he needs.
What about your queen? Darylon asked. Did he control her, too, before she fell ill, I mean?
Not even a little, Vanion replied. Aldreas was a weak king who did anything Annias told him to do. Elana's an altogether different matter, and she despises Annias.
He shrugged.
But she's ill, and Annias will have a free hand until she recovers.
Abriel began to pace up and down, his lined face deep in thought.
That would seem to be our logical course, then, gentlemen. We must bend all of our efforts to finding a cure for Queen Alana's illness.
Darylon leaned back, his fingers tapping on the polished table. Annias is very cunning, he observed. He will easily guess what our course is likely to be, and he's certain to try to block us. Even if we succeed in finding a cure, won't that immediately put the queen's life in danger?
Sparhawk is her champion, my lord, Colton told him. He can cope, particularly if I'm there to back him up.
Are you making any progress on a cure, Vanion? Comier asked.
The local physicians are all baffled, Vanion replied. I've sent out requests for others, though, but most of them haven't arrived as yet.
Physicians don't always respond to requests, Abriel noted. This might be particularly true in a situation where the head of the Royal Council has a certain interest in not seeing the Queen recover. He considered the problem.
The Cyrenics have many contacts in Camoria, he said. Have you considered taking your Queen to the medical faculty at the University of Barata in that kingdom? They're reputed to be experts in obscure ailments.
I don't think we dare dissolve the encasement that surrounds her, Sophrenia said. At the moment, it's all that sustains her life. She could not survive a trip to Barata.
The preceptor of the Cyrenic Knights nodded thoughtfully.
Perhaps you're right, madam, he said.
Not only that, Vanion added. Annias would never let us take her out of the palace.
Abriel nodded bleakly. He considered it for a moment.
There's an alternative. It's not as good as having the physician actually look at the patient, but sometimes it works, or so I've been told. A skilled physician can learn a great deal from a detailed description of symptoms.
That would be my suggestion, Vanion. Write down everything you know about Queen Alana's illness, and send someone to Barata with the documents.
I'll take it, Sparhawk said quietly. I have certain personal reasons for wanting the Queen restored to health. Besides, Martell's in Camoria, or at least he's reputed to be, and he and I have a few things to discuss.
That raises another point, Abriel said. There's a great deal of turmoil in Camoria right now. Someone's been stirring up civil unrest there. It's not the safest place in the world.
Comier leaned back again.
What would you gentlemen say to a little show of unity? He said to the other preceptors.
What did you have in mind? Darylon asked.
I'd say that we all have a stake in this, Comier replied. Our common goal is to keep Annias off the Archprelate's throne. We all have champions who stand above their comrades in skill and bravery. I think it might be a good idea for us each to select one of those champions and send him to join Sparhawk in Camoria. The assistance couldn't hurt, and the sending of men from all four orders would convince the world that the Church Knights stand as one in this matter.
Very good, Comier, Darylon agreed. The militant orders have had their differences in the past few centuries, and too many people still think that we're divided.
He turned to Abriel. Have you any idea who's behind the trouble in Camoria? He asked.
Many believe that it's Otha, the Cyrenic replied. He's been infiltrating the Central Kingdoms for the past 6 months or so.
You know, Comier said, I've got a strong feeling that someday we're going to have to do something about Otha. Something fairly permanent.
That would involve coming up against Azash, Sophrenia said, and I'm not sure we want to do that.
Can't the younger gods of Styricum do something about him? Comier asked her.
They choose not to, she replied. The wars of men are bad enough, but a war between the gods would be dreadful beyond imagining.
She looked at Dolmant.
The god of the Alenes is reputed to be all-powerful, she said. Couldn't the Church appeal to him to confront Azash?
It's possible, I suppose, the patriarch said. The only problem is that the church does not admit the existence of Azash, or any other Styric god. It's a matter of theology.
How very short-sighted.
Dolmant laughed.
My dear Sophrania, he said, I thought you knew that was the nature of the ecclesiastical mind. We're all like that. We find one truth and embrace it. Then we close our eyes to everything else. It avoids confusion. He looked at her curiously. Tell me, Sophrania, which heathen god do you worship?
I'm not permitted to say, she answered gravely. I can tell you that it's not a god, though. I serve a goddess.
A female deity? What an absurd idea.
Only to a man, Dolmant. Women find it very natural.
Is there anything else you think we ought to know, Vanion?
Comier asked.
I think we've just about covered everything, Comier.
Vanion looked at Sparhawk. Anything you want to add? He asked.
Sparhawk shook his head.
No, he said. I don't think so.
What about that Styric who set the church soldiers on us?
Colton asked.
Sparhawk grunted.
I'd almost forgotten that, he admitted.
It was at about the time that I heard Krager and Harperin talking. Colton and I were wearing disguises, but there was a Styric who saw through them. Not long after that, we were attacked by some of Anius's people.
You think there's a connection? Comier asked.
Sparhawk nodded. The Styric had been following me around for several days, and I'm fairly sure he was the one who pointed Colton and me out to the soldiers. That would connect him to Anius.
It's pretty thin, Sparhawk. Anius has some fairly well-known prejudices where Styrics are concerned.
Not so many that he wouldn't seek out their help if he thought he needed it. On two occasions I've caught him using magic.
A churchman?
Dolman's expression was startled.
That's strictly forbidden.
So was plotting the murder of Count Radon, Your Grace. I don't think Anius pays too much attention to the rules. He's not much of a magician, but the fact that he knows how it's done indicates that he's had instruction. And that means a Styric.
Darylon interlaced his slender fingers on the table in front of him.
There are Styrics and then there are Styrics, he noted. As Abriel pointed out, there's been a great deal of Styric activity in the Central Kingdoms of late, much of it coming out of Zamok. If Anius sought out a Styric to instruct him in the secrets, he might possibly have contacted the wrong one.
I think you're overcomplicating things, Darylon, Dolmant said. Not even Anius would have dealings with Otha.
That's presuming that he knows he's dealing with Otha.
My lords, Sophrania said very quietly, consider what happened this morning. Her eyes were very intent. Would any of you, or the kings you serve, have been deceived by the transparent accusations of the primate Anius? They were crude, obvious, even childish. You Alenes are a subtle, sophisticated people. If your minds had been alert, you'd have laughed at Anius's clumsy attempts to discredit the Pandions. But you didn't. Neither did your kings. And Anius, who's as subtle as a serpent, presented his case as if he believed it was a stroke of genius.
Exactly what are you getting at, Sophrania? Vanion asked.
I think we should give some consideration to Lord Darylon's line of thought. The presentation this morning would have overwhelmed a Styric. We are a simple people, and our magicians do not have to work very hard to persuade us to their way of thinking. You Alenes are more skeptical, more logical. You are not so easily deceived, unless you've been tampered with.
Dolmant leaned forward, his eyes betraying his eagerness for a contest at logic.
But Anius is also an Alene, with a mind trained in theological disputation. Why would he have been so clumsy?
You're assuming that Anius was speaking in his own voice this morning, Dolmant. A Styric sorcerer, or some creature subject to one, would present his case in terms that would be understood by a simple Styric, and then rely upon magic to induce belief.
Was someone using that kind of magic in that room this morning? Darylon asked, his face troubled.
Yes, she replied simply.
I think we're getting a bit far afield, Comier said. What we need to do right now is get Sparhawk on his way to Baratta. The quicker we find a cure for Queen Alana's illness, the quicker we can eliminate the threat of Anius altogether.
Once we cut off his supply of ready cash, he can consort with anybody or anything he wants to, for all I care.
You'd better get ready to ride, Sparhawk, Fanion said. I'll write down the Queen's symptoms for you.
I don't think that's necessary, Vanion, Sophrenia told him. I know her condition in much greater detail than you do.
But you can't write, Sophrenia, he reminded her.
I won't have to, Vanion, she said sweetly. I'll tell the physicians in Boratta about the symptoms personally.
You're going with Sparhawk? Vanion looked surprised.
Of course. There are things afoot that seem to be focusing on him. He might need my help when he gets to Camoria.
I'll go along, too, Calton said. If Sparhawk catches up with Martell in Camoria, I want to be there to see what happens.
He grinned at his friend.
I'll let you have Martell, he offered, if you'll give me Addis.
Sounds fair, Sparhawk agreed.
You'll be passing through Kyrolos on your way to Boratta, Dolman said. I'll ride along with you as far as that.
We'll be honored to have you, Your Grace. Sparhawk looked at Count Radon.
Might you want to join us as well, my lord? He asked.
No. Thanks all the same, Sir Sparhawk, the Count replied. I'll return to Arsham with my nephew and Lord Abriel.
Comier was frowning slightly.
I don't want to delay you, Sparhawk, he said. But Darylon is right. Annius is sure to guess what our next step is likely to be. There are only so many centers of medical learning in Eosia. If this Martell fellow was already in Camoria and still taking orders from Annius, he's almost certain to try to keep you from reaching Boratta. I think it might be best if you waited in Kyrolos until the knights from our other orders catch up with you. A show of force can sometimes avoid difficulties.
That's a good idea, Fanion agreed. The others can join him at the Pandion Chapter House in Kyrolos and ride out together from there. Sparhawk rose to his feet.
That's it, then, he said.
He glanced at Sophrenia. Are you going to leave Flute here?
No. She goes with me.
It's going to be dangerous, he warned.
I can protect her if she needs protection. Besides, the decision is not mine to make.
Don't you love talking with her? Calton said. All the mental stimulation of trying to puzzle out the meaning of what she's saying.
Sparhawk ignored that.
Later in the courtyard, where Sparhawk and the others were preparing to mount for the ride to Kyrolos, the novice Beirut approached.
There's a lame beggar boy at the gate, my lord, he said to Sparhawk. He says he has something urgent to tell you.
Let him through the gates, Sparhawk said.
Beirut looked a bit shocked.
I know the boy, Sparhawk said. He works for me.
As you wish, my lord, Beirut said, bowing. He turned back toward the gate.
Oh, by the way, Beirut, Sparhawk said.
My lord?
Don't walk too close to the boy. He's a thief, and he can steal everything you own before you go 10 paces.
I'll keep that in mind, my lord.
A few minutes later, Beirut came back, escorting Talon.
I've got a problem, Sparhawk, the boy said.
Oh?
Some of the primate's men found out that I've been helping you. They're looking for me all over Cimera.
I told you that you were going to get in trouble, Curic growled at him. Then the squire looked at Sparhawk.
What do we do now? He asked. I don't want him locked up in the cathedral dungeon.
Sparhawk scratched his chin.
I guess he'll have to go with us, he said, at least as far as Deimos.
He grinned suddenly.
We can leave him with Asladi and the boys.
Are you insane, Sparhawk?
I thought you'd be delighted at the notion, Curic. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life.
Don't you want him to get to know his brothers?
Sparhawk looked at the boy.
How much did you steal from Beirut here? He bluntly asked the young thief.
Not very much, really. Give it all back.
I'm very disappointed in you, Sparhawk.
Life is filled with disappointments. Now give it back.
Chapter 11 It was mid-afternoon when they rode across the drawbridge and onto the road leading to Deimos and beyond. The wind still blew, but the sky was clearing. The long road stretching toward Deimos was teeming with traffic. Carts and wagons rattled by,
and drably dressed peasants with heavy bundles on their shoulders plodded slowly toward the marketplaces of Simara. The raw winter wind bent the yellow grass at the sides of the road. Sparhawk rode a few paces in advance of the others, and the travelers on their way to Simara gave way to him. Farron was prancing again as they rode along at a steady trot.
"Your horse seems restive, Sparhawk," the Patriarch Dolmant, wrapped in a heavy black ecclesiastical cloak over his cassock, observed.
"He's just showing off," Sparhawk replied back over his shoulder. "He has some notion that it impresses me. It gives him something to do while he's waiting for the chance to bite somebody," Colton laughed.
"Is he vicious?"
"It's the nature of the war horse, Your Grace," Sparhawk explained. "They're bred for aggressiveness. In Farron's case, they just went too far."
"Has he ever bitten you?"
"Once. Then I explained to him that I'd rather he didn't do it anymore."
"Explained?"
"I used a stout stick. He got the idea almost immediately."
"We're not going to get too far this afternoon, Sparhawk," Curick called from his position at the rear of the party where he rode with their pair of pack horses. "We started late. There's an inn I know of about a league ahead. What do you think of the idea of stopping there, getting a good night's sleep, and starting out early in the morning?"
"It makes sense, Sparhawk," Colton agreed. "I don't enjoy sleeping on the ground that much anymore."
"All right," Sparhawk said. He glanced at Talon, who was riding a tired-looking bay horse beside Sophrania's white palfrey. The boy kept looking back over his shoulder apprehensively.
"You're being awfully quiet," he said.
"Young people aren't supposed to talk in the presence of their elders, Sparhawk," Talon replied glibly. "That's one of the things they taught me in that school Curick sent me to. I try to obey the rules, when it doesn't inconvenience me too much."
"The young man is pert," Dolmant observed. "He's also a thief, Your Grace," Colton warned. "Don't get too close to him if you have any valuables about you."
Dolmant looked sternly at the boy.
"Aren't you aware of the fact that thievery is frowned upon by the Church?"
"Yes," Talon sighed. "I know. The Church is very straight-laced about things like that."
"Watch your mouth, Talon," Curick snapped.
"I can't, Curick. My nose gets in the way."
"The lad's depravity is perhaps understandable," Dolmant said tolerantly. "I doubt that he's received much instruction in doctrine or morality."
He sighed.
"In many ways the poor children of the streets are as pagan as the Styrix."
He smiled slyly at Sophrania, who rode with flute bundled up in an old cloak in front of her saddle. "Actually, Your Grace," Talon disagreed, "I attend church services regularly, and I always pay close attention to the sermons."
"That's surprising," the Patriarch said.
"Not really, Your Grace," Talon said. "Most thieves go to church.
The offertory provides all sorts of splendid opportunities."
Dolmant looked suddenly aghast. "Look at it this way, Your Grace," Talon explained with mock seriousness. "The church distributes money to the poor, doesn't she?"
"Of course."
"Well, I'm one of the poor, so I take my share when the plate goes by. It saves the church all the time and trouble of looking me up to give me the money. I like to be helpful when I can." Dolmant stared at him, then suddenly burst out laughing. Some few miles farther along, they encountered a small band of people dressed in the crude homespun tunics that identified them as Styrick. They were on foot, and as soon as they saw Sparhawk and the others, they ran fearfully out into a nearby field.
"Why are they so frightened?" Talon asked, puzzled.
"News travels very rapidly in Styricum," Sophrania replied, "and there have been incidents lately."
"Incidents?"
Briefly, Sparhawk told him what had happened in the Styric village in Arsham. Talon's face went very pale.
"That's awful," he exclaimed.
"The church has tried for hundreds of years to stamp out that sort of thing," Dolmant said sadly.
"I think we stamped it out fairly completely in that part of Arsham," Sparhawk assured him.
"I sent some men out to deal with the peasants who were responsible."
"Did you hang them?"
Talon asked fiercely.
"Sophrania wouldn't let us, so my men gave them a switching instead."
"That's all?"
"They used thorn bushes for switches.
Thorns grow very long down in Arsham, and I instructed my men to be thorough about it.
A bit extreme, perhaps, Dolmant said.
It seemed fitting at the time, Your Grace. The Church Knights have close ties with the Styrix, and we don't like people who mistreat our friends. The pale winter sun was sliding into a bank of chill purple cloud behind them when they arrived at a run-down wayside inn. They ate a barely adequate meal of thin soup and greasy mutton, and retired early. It was clear and cold the following morning. The road was frozen iron hard, and the bracken lining its sides was white with frost. The sun was very bright, but there was little warmth to it. They rode briskly, wrapped tightly in their cloaks to ward off the biting chill. The road undulated across the hills and valleys of central Alania, passing through fields lying fallow under the winter sky. Sparhawk looked about as he rode. This was the region where he and Calton had grown up, and he felt that peculiar sense of homecoming all men feel when returning after many years to the scenes of their childhood. The self-discipline, which was so much a part of Pandion training, usually made Sparhawk suppress any form of emotionalism, but despite his best efforts, certain things sometimes touched him deeply. About mid-morning, Curic called ahead.
"There's a rider coming up behind us," he reported. "He's pushing his horse hard."
Sparhawk reined in and wheeled Farron around. "Calton," he said sharply.
"Right," the big blonde man replied, thrusting his cloak aside so that his sword hilt was clear.
Sparhawk also cleared his sword, and the two of them rode several hundred yards back along the road to intercept the oncoming horseman. Their precautions, however, proved unnecessary. The rider was the young novice, Bayret. He was wrapped in a plain cloak, and his hands and wrists were chapped by the morning chill. His horse, however, was lathered and steaming. He reined in and approached them at a walk.
"I have a message for you from Lord Vanion, Sir Sparhawk," he said.
"What is it?" Sparhawk asked him.
"The Royal Council has legitimized Prince Lycaeus."
"They did what?"
"When the kings of Thalesia, Deira, and Arsham insisted that a bastard could not serve as Prince Regent, the Primate Annius called the council into session, and they declared the prince to be legitimate. The Primate produced a document that stated that the Princess Arissa had been married to Duke Ostin of Vardanias."
"That's absurd," Sparhawk fumed.
"That's what Lord Vanion thought. The document appeared to be quite genuine, though, and Duke Ostin died years ago, so there wasn't any way to refute the claim. The Earl of Lenda examined the parchment very closely, and finally even he had to vote to legitimize Lycaeus."
Sparhawk swore. "I knew Duke Ostin," Calton said. "He was a confirmed bachelor. There's no way he'd have married. He despised women." "Is there some problem?" Patriarch Dolmant asked, riding back down the road to join them with Sophrenia, Curic, and Talon close behind him.
"The Royal Council has voted to legitimize Lycaeus," Calton told him. "Annius produced a paper that says that Princess Arissa was married."
"How strange," Dolmant said.
"And how convenient," Sophrenia added.
"Could the document have been falsified?" Dolmant asked.
"Easily, Your Grace," Talon told him.
"I know a man in Simera who could provide irrefutable proof that Archprelate Clavonus has 9 wives, including a lady troll and an ogress."
"Well, it's done now," Sparhawk said. "It puts Lycaeus one step closer to the throne, I'm afraid."
"When did this happen, Bayret?" Curic asked the novice.
"Late last night."
Curic scratched at his beard.
"Princess Arissa's cloistered at Deimos," he said. "If Annius came up with this scheme just recently, she may not know she's a wife."
"Widow," Bayret corrected.
"All right, widow, then. Arissa's always been rather proud of the fact that she lay down with just about every man in Simera, begging your pardon, Your Grace, and that she did it on her own terms without ever having been to the altar.
If someone approached her right, it shouldn't be too hard to get her to sign a statement that she's never been married. Wouldn't that sort of muddy up the waters a little?"
"Where did you find this man, Sparhawk?" Calton asked admiringly.
"He's a treasure."
Sparhawk was thinking very fast now. "Legitimacy or illegitimacy is a civil matter," he noted, "since it has to do with inheritance rights and things such as that. But the wedding ceremony is always a religious one, isn't it, Your Grace?" Yes, Dolmant agreed. If you and I were to get the kind of statement from Arissa that Keurig just mentioned, could the church issue a declaration of her spinsterhood? Dolmant considered it.
It's highly irregular, he said dubiously.
But it is possible.
I suppose so, yes.
Then Annius could be ordered by the church to withdraw his spurious document, couldn't he?
Of course.
Sparhawk turned to Calton.
Who inherited Duke Oston's lands and titles? He asked.
His nephew. A complete ass. He's very impressed with his dukedom, and he spends money faster than he earns it.
How would he react if he were suddenly disinherited and the lands and title were passed to Lycaeus instead?
You'd be able to hear the screams in Thalesia. A slow smile crossed Sparhawk's face.
I know an honest magistrate in Vardanias, and the affair would be in his jurisdiction. If the current duke were to take the matter into litigation, and if he presented the church declaration to support his position, the magistrate would rule in his favor, wouldn't he?
Calton grinned broadly.
He wouldn't have any choice.
Wouldn't that sort of delegitimize Lycaeus again? Dolmant was smiling. Then he assumed a pious expression.
Let us press on to Deimos, dear friends, he suggested. I feel a sudden yearning to hear the confession of a certain sinner.
Do you know something? Talon said. I always thought that thieves were the most devious people in the world. But nobles and churchmen make us look like amateurs.
How would Platamay handle the situation? Calton asked as they set off again.
He'd stick a knife in Lycaeus, Talon shrugged. Dead bastards can't inherit thrones, can they?
Calton laughed.
It has a certain direct charm, I'll admit.
You cannot solve the world's problems by murder, Calton, Dolmant said disapprovingly.
Oh, your grace, I wasn't talking about murder. The church knights are the soldiers of God. If God tells us to kill somebody, it's an act of faith, not murder. Do you suppose the church could see its way clear to instruct Sparhawk and me to dispatch Lycaeus and Annius? And Otha, too, as long as we're at it?
Absolutely not.
Calton sighed.
It was only a thought.
Who's Otha? Talon asked curiously.
Where did you grow up, boy? Bayret asked him.
In the streets.
Even in the streets you must have heard of the Emperor of Zamok.
Where's Zamok?
If you'd stayed in that school I put you in, you'd know, Keurig growled.
Schools bore me, Keurig, the boy responded. They spent months trying to teach me my letters. Once I learned how to write my own name, I didn't think I needed any of the rest of it.
That's why you don't know where Zamok is, or why Otha may be the one who kills you.
Why would somebody I don't even know want to kill me?
Because you're an Aline.
Everybody's an Aline, except for the Styrix, of course.
This boy has a long way to go, Calton observed. Somebody ought to take him in hand.
If it please you, my lords, Bayret said, choosing his words carefully, largely Sparhawk guessed because of the presence of the revered patriarch of Deimos, I know that you have pressing matters on your minds. I was never more than a passing fair scholar of history, but I will undertake the instruction of this urchin in the rudiments of the subject.
I love to listen to this young man talk, Calton said. The formality almost makes me swoon with delight.
Urchin!
Talon objected loudly. Bayret's expression did not change. With an almost casual, backhanded swipe, he knocked Talon out of his saddle.
Your first lesson, young man, is respect for your teacher, he said. Never question his words.
Talon came up sputtering and with a small dagger in his fist. Bayret leaned back in his saddle and kicked him solidly in the chest, knocking the wind out of him.
Don't you just adore the learning process? Calton asked Sparhawk.
Now get back on your horse, Bayret said firmly, and pay attention. I will test you from time to time, and your answers had better be correct.
Are you going to let him do this? Talon appealed to his father.
Keurig grinned at him.
This isn't fair,
Talon complained, climbing back into his saddle.
He wiped at his bleeding nose.
You see what you did?
He accused Bayret. Press your finger against your upper lip, Barrett suggested, and don't speak without permission.
What was that?
Talon demanded incredulously. Barrett raised his fist.
All right,
Talon said, cringing away from the offered blow.
Go ahead.
I'll listen.
I always enjoy seeing a hunger for knowledge in the young, Dolmant observed blandly.
And so Talon's education began as they rode on to Deimos. At first he was quite sullen about it, but after a few hours of listening to Barrett, he began to be caught up in the story.
Can I ask questions?
He said finally. Of course, Barrett replied.
You said that there weren't any kingdoms in those days, just a lot of duchies and the like?
Barrett nodded.
Then how did this Abrek of Deira gain control of the whole country in the 15th century? Didn't the other nobles fight him?
Abrek had control of the iron mines in central Deira. His warriors had steel weapons and armor. The people facing him were armed with bronze or even flint.
That would make a difference, I guess.
After he had consolidated his hold on Deira, he turned south into what's now Elania. It didn't take him very long to conquer the entire region. Then he moved down into Arsham and repeated the process there. After that he turned toward central Eosia, Camoria, Lamarkand, and Pelosia.
Did he conquer all of Eosia?
No. It was about that time that the Ashandist heresy arose in Rendor, and Abrek was persuaded by the church to give himself over to its suppression.
I've heard about the Ashandists, Talon said, but I could never get the straight of what they really believe.
Ashand was anti-hierarchical.
What does that mean?
The hierarchy is composed of higher church officials, primates, patriarchs, and the archprelate. Ishand believed that individual priests should decide matters of theology for their congregations, and that the hierarchy of the church should be disbanded.
I can see why high churchmen disliked him then.
At any rate, Abrek gathered a huge army from western and central Eosia to move against Rendor. His eyes were fixed on heaven, and so when the earls and dukes of the lands he had conquered asked for steel weapons, the better to fight the heretics, they said, he gave his consent without considering the implications.
There were a few battles, but then Abrek's empire suddenly disintegrated.
Now that they had the advanced technology that the Deirans had kept secret before, the nobles of West and Central Eosia no longer felt obliged to pay homage to Abrek.
Elania and Arsham declared their independence, and Camoria, Lamarkand, and Pelosia all coalesced into strong kingdoms.
Abrek himself was killed in a battle with the Ashandists in southern Camoria.
What's all this got to do with Zamok?
I'll get to that in due time. Talon looked over at Curic.
You know, he said, this is a good story. Why didn't they tell it in that school you put me in?
Probably because you didn't stay long enough to give them the chance.
That's possible, I suppose.
How much farther is it to Deimos? Colton asked, squinting at the late afternoon sun to gauge the time.
About 12 leagues, Curic replied.
We'll never make that before nightfall. Is there an inn or a tavern hereabouts?
There's a village a ways up ahead. They have an inn.
What do you think, Sparhawk? Colton asked.
I suppose we might as well, the big man agreed.
We wouldn't do the horses any good by riding them all night in the cold. The sun was going down as they rode up a long hill toward the village. Since it was behind them, it projected their shadows far out to the front. The village was small, with thatched-roofed stone houses clustered together on either side of the road. The inn at the far end was hardly more than a taproom with a sleeping loft on the second floor. The supper they were provided, however, was far better than the poor fare they had been offered the previous night.
"Are we going to the Mother House when we get to Deimos?" Colton asked Sparhawk after they had eaten in the low, torch-lit common room.
Sparhawk considered it.
"It's probably being watched," he said.
"Escorting the Patriarch back to Kyrelos gives us an excuse to be passing through Deimos, but I'd rather not have anyone see His Grace and me go into the cloister to talk with Arissa. If Aeneas gets any clues about what we've got planned, he'll try to counter us.
Curic, have you got any spare room at your house?"
"There's an attic and a hayloft."
"Good. We'll be visiting you."
"Aslaadi will be delighted."
Curic's eyes grew troubled.
"Can I talk with you for a moment, Sparhawk?" Sparhawk pushed back his stool and followed his squire to the far side of the flagstone-floored room. "You weren't really serious about leaving Talon with his Lottie, were you?" Kurek asked quietly.
"No," Sparhawk replied. "Probably not. You were right when you said that she might be very unhappy if she finds out about your indiscretion, and Talon has a busy mouth. He could let things slip."
"What are we going to do with him, then?"
"I haven't decided yet. Feyreth's looking after him and keeping him out of trouble."
Kurek smiled. "I expect it's the first time in his life that Talon's come up against somebody who won't tolerate his clever mouth. That lesson may be more important than all the history he's picking up."
The same thought had occurred to me. Sparhawk glanced over at the novice, who was talking respectfully with Sophronia.
"I've got a feeling that Bayrit's going to make a very good Pandion," he said. "He's got character and intelligence, and he was very good in that fight down in Arsham."
"He was fighting on foot," Kurek said. "We'll know better when we see how he handles a lance."
"Kurek, you've got the soul of a drill sergeant. Somebody's got to do it, Sparhawk."
It was cold again the following morning, and the horses' breath steamed in the frosty air as they set out. After they had gone about a mile, Bayrit resumed his instruction.
"All right," he said to Talon. "Tell me what you learned yesterday."
Talon was tightly wrapped in a patched old gray cloak that had once belonged to Kurek, and he was shivering, but he glibly recited back what Bayrit had told him the day before. So far as Sparhawk could tell, the boy repeated Bayrit's words verbatim.
"You have a very good memory, Talon," Bayrit congratulated him.
"It's a trick," Talon replied with uncharacteristic modesty. "Sometimes I carry messages for Platamie, so I've learned how to memorize things."
"Who's Platamie?"
"The best thief in Simera. At least he was before he got so fat."
"Do you consort with thieves?"
"I'm a thief myself, Bayrit. It's an ancient and honorable profession."
"Hardly honorable."
"That depends on your point of view." "All right, what happened after King Abrek got killed?"
"The war with the Ashandists settled down into a stalemate," Bayrit took up the account. "There were raids back and forth across the Inner Sea and the Arshan Straits, but the nobles on both sides had other things on their minds. Ashand had died, and his successors were not nearly as zealous as he'd been. The hierocracy of the church in Kyrelos kept trying to prod the nobility into pressing the war, but the nobles were far more interested in politics than in theology."
"How long did it go on like that?"
"For nearly 3 centuries.
They took their wars seriously in those days, didn't they?"
"Wait a minute. Where were the church knights during all this?"
"I'm just coming to that.
When it became obvious that the nobility had lost its enthusiasm for the war, the hierocracy gathered in Kyrelos to consider alternatives. What finally emerged was the idea of founding the militant orders to continue the struggle. The knights of the four orders all received training far beyond that given ordinary warriors. In addition, they were given instruction in the secrets of Styricum."
"What are those?"
"Magic."
"Oh, why didn't you say so?"
"I did. Pay attention, Talon."
"Did the church knights win the war, then?"
"They conquered all of Rendor, and the Ashandists finally capitulated. During their early years, the militant orders were ambitious, and they began to carve Rendor up into 4 huge duchies. But then a far worse danger came out of the east."
"Zamok?" Talon guessed.
"Exactly. The invasion of Lamarkand came without any..."
"Sparhawk," Colton said sharply. "Up there." He pointed at a nearby hilltop. 12 armed men had suddenly come riding over the crest and were crashing down through the bracken at a gallop. Sparhawk and Colton drew their swords and spurred forward to meet the charge. Kurek ranged out to one side, shaking a spiked chain mace free from his saddle. Bayrit took the other side, wielding his heavy-bladed battle axe. The 2 armored knights crashed into the center of the charge. Sparhawk felled 2 of the attackers in quick succession as Colton chopped another out of his saddle with a rapid series of savage sword strokes. 1 man tried to flank them but fell twitching as Kurek's mace crushed in the side of his head. Sparhawk and Colton were in the very center of the attackers now, swinging their heavy broadswords in vast overhand strokes. Then Bayrit charged in from the flank, his axe crunching into the bodies of the riders on that side. After a few moments of concerted violence, the survivors broke and fled.
End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.